Bernadette O'Hara, do you have any idea what time it is?
I'm not gonna leave you alone with... What is that?
Come here, Winston, give Mummy head.
Hi, everybody. My name is Dana Kimmel from Friday the 13th Part 3 and Sweet 16. And you're all, like, totally listening to the hysteria continues and stuff. Awesome!
And you, I bet you can imagine how excited we were to get that voicemail from Dana and to know such a great screen queen is listening to the show. And so thank you for joining us again. Hysteria continues, episode number 7. I'm Justin, the person in charge of Hysteria Lives and author of Teenage Wasteland, and I'm joined as ever by Joseph.
Right, that was my poor Fat Albert impression.
Excellent.
I told you I have to do new intros every time, so.
Absolutely. We've got to keep it creative. And yes. Eric from Ireland.
I cringe my dribblies at your splendid puffle snoo.
Wow, okay, this is all new to me. Nathan, what have you got for us?
Susie Double Toya. There's my references.
I can see that one's going to run. Well, again, welcome to Hysteria Continues. We've got a great show for you, action-packed. Well, kind of action-packed. We're going to be talking, as ever, about some of the slasher films we've seen recently, and one of them you probably are aware of, out at the cinemas on Friday, Scream 4. We'll talk about that in a minute. And just to let you know, we're going to keep it spoiler-free, because myself, I saw it this morning, so did Eric, and Joseph thinks saw it on Friday night, but Nathan hasn't had the pleasure yet, so we're going to keep it spoiler free. We're also going to be looking at two Canadian slashers, both early 80s, A Funeral Home and Curtains, both starring the lovely Leslie Donaldson, who graciously joined us. It was about a couple of weeks ago now that we spoke to Leslie, so we're going to speak to her. Recorded interview about halfway through the show. So, guys, shall we talk about Scream 4? Shall I play a trailer for it, which, again, has got no spoilers that I'm aware of? Here we go.
Robert's residence.
Welcome home, Sydney. You're a survivor, aren't you, Sydney? What good's it to be a survivor if everyone close to you is dead? You can't save them. All you can do is watch.
Modern audiences have become savvy to the rules of the originals. I mean, there are still rules, but the rules have changed.
And the kill has got to be, like, way more extreme.
The unexpected is the new cliche.
And virgins can die now.
Be the new version, you know, 2.0. The killer should be filming the murders.
That's a natural next step in psycho-slasher innovation.
Go ahead if you have the guts.
Well, it's time for someone new to die.
These aren't just random killings.
There's something really scary about a guy with a knife who just snaps.
I hear you like horror movies.
It's for you.
And there you go. It's a trailer for the long-awaited, long-in-gestation Scream 4. And I said before, we're going to keep it resolutely spoiler-free because I'm sure lots of people haven't seen it. I know Nathan, as we said, hasn't seen it. Guys, Joseph, what did you think? That doesn't sound good.
Unfortunately, I really did not like it as well as I really wanted to. Obviously, I'm going to try to give away as little as possible since Nathan hasn't seen it, but I thought it was another Wes Craven rush job that was kind of made by a studio rather than a director. Like his recent directorial duties on My Soul to Take, Scream Greens, if you'll pardon the pun, studio interference. It's sloppy, disjointed, and kind of rushed. In order to make a quick buck, which I'm sure it will amass plenty. My problem with the film is that the joke presented in the original Scream has become the central premise rather than the backbone, and it often takes you out of the Scream universe with its barrage of sledgehammer-like comedic attempts. There's one death scene in particular that had me kind of groaning and shifting in my seat. The conceit this time around is that rather than lampoon slasher films, their sequels, or even their place in trilogy history, you have essentially a bunch of characters poking at the reboot concept while also toying with the YouTube generation's easily accessible fame. Now, I thought this was a clever idea, but whereas most teenagers these days can't be bothered to sit through one of these reboots without thumbing through their iPhones, Scream 4 has several characters who know these films inside and out and even decide late in the film to attend a 7-movie marathon, which kind of going its jabs at the detached ADD generation, I kind of thought rang untrue. There's not really much else I can say about it except that I kind of guessed the killer's identity or identities, perhaps, 15 minutes in, so that took some of the joy out of the final reveal. All the new characters were pretty unlikable, Twitter-friendly drones, and kind of represented that generational gap that has me avoiding the cinemas altogether these days. And all the old characters kind of just stood around with not much to do. Finally, Scream 4 was easily the worst cinema-going experience of my life and has, for the time, put me off shelling out $10 to see a movie on its first run. I get to the showing, and immediately the teens in the audience are on their cell phones, talking loudly, the usual. About 20 minutes in, one patron started yelling obscenities at another for talking loudly, you know, which was okay, but then a shoving match broke out. At one point, I and the rest of the audience kind of yelled at Enderthal, sit down and shut your fucking mouth so the people who paid to watch the movie can actually watch the movie. Let's see. The manager finally came in and kind of alerted the two that were shoving each other that the cops were waiting outside. He apologized for the inconvenience and had the projectionist rewind the film. It was pretty quiet for the next 10 or 15 minutes after that, but eventually the cell phone lights lighted up again and voices started to raise again. And, meh, ho-hum. I like the first three a lot better.
Okay, how about you, Eric?
I liked it a lot more than Joseph did, although I still have reservations. I think that it opens quite strongly, and I think the opening is going to maybe divide people. I think a lot of people are going to be like, oh, for fuck's sake, when they see the opening sequence. But I thought it was really clever and great fun, and I think the finale is brilliant as well. It's very over the top and very in the tradition of Happy Birthday to Me, our urban legend. It was the bit in between that bothered me. It got kind of repetitive and tedious, and this is a problem I've had with a lot of the Scream films, is the kill sequences are just basically stab, 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 and they, you know, and then it repeats to fade, kind of. It could have done with a bit more variety, I felt. I think the film's at strongest when it's concentrating on the established characters, particularly Courtney Cox as Gail Weathers, who is my favourite character from the series. When it goes to the newer characters, I found my interest beginning to wane a bit, particularly the cinema club people who I couldn't wait to see meet their maker. For me, possibly a 6 out of 10 movie, I'd say. I mean, I really did enjoy the opening 20 minutes. I was beaming. I was like, this is really good. I'm really enjoying this. It's taking me back to, you know, when I saw the Scream trilogy first time around. But then the next 45 minutes, you know, I was tempted to take out my iPhone and start going on Facebook.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I saw it this morning, a very empty screening, because it was early this morning. And I just hark back to when I saw the first film in 1996. And because I've been a slasher fan for so long, but it being like a guilty pleasure or a guilty secret, I mean, nobody really watched slasher movies back in the 90s. And there wasn't actually the love, and there wasn't the internet either. So basically it was kind of a dirty little secret, my own dirty little secret, and I didn't really know anyone else who watched slasher movies. So when the first film came out, and I always remember it was Wes Craven's new Thriller, they didn't call it a slasher movie because slasher movies are so out of vogue then. But then it became the cause célèbre, and it was one of my best cinema-going experiences. I saw the film twice. And I always say it's quite interesting the way when you see it with an audience, it either sometimes makes or breaks a movie. And it's a shame that, obviously, Joseph, sounds like you had a really bad experience. When I saw the original the first time, it's funny, the audience saw it as a horror movie, a thriller, slasher. there's lots of screams and jumps and gasps. The second time I saw it, the audience seemed to see it as a comedy, and they were laughing more along with it, which is kind of funny, but I think that's why it worked in so well. Now, I agree. I mean, I liked the film a lot more than Joseph did, and possibly even a little bit more than you did, Eric. I did enjoy it a lot, but it certainly is a bit of a mess. It's tonally, it's all over the place. It's not particularly coherent. It smacks of studio interference. And, you know, I mean, there's probably a far more interesting story behind the scenes about what happened with Kevin Williamson being fired or leaving, Wes Craven being made to reshoot stuff. I mean, it sounds like it was a bit of a nightmare for all concerned. But I did, you know, really enjoy it. There were some fantastic suspense sequences, and not giving anything away, but there was one sequence in a underground car park which harks back to Leslie Donaldson's famous opening scene in Happy Birthday to Me. Where it did fall down was some of the humour just didn't work. And what I didn't like about it was the way that the first three films, the humour bounced off the self-reflective nature of the films, and you know, humorous asides, but the horror was kept pretty horrific. And there was a very good balance in almost all three films that managed to do that. Whereas in this film, there were some really horrific sequences which were followed by a joke at the end of each one, like a quip, somebody making a quip as they're dying, which it kind of really took me out of the film, and it made it, it didn't, that, I found that, well, sort of upsetting.
That bit reminded me of the line, "It sucks on so many levels," from Jason X. That, like, that type of vibe permeates the film, I think.
Yeah. Not to spoil any more, but the Bruce Willis bit, you know what I'm talking
about. That's the bit I'm talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly, yeah.
Really irritated. It really irritated me, I think. Mm. It just kind of went on, and I was like, ugh.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll come back and talk about Scream 4, and obviously, you know, the risk of, we don't want to spoil it for anyone, and obviously Nathan's yet to see it, and we don't want him to find out that Courtney Cox's plastic surgeon is the killer. unless you've got anything else to say about the film, guys, have we seen anything else we want to have a chat about?
I saw, first time I saw Terror at Red Wolf Inn, which I thought was a pretty good black comedy with a lot of good slasher film undertones, but there, I'm not going to say much more about it because, well, never mind.
Okay, well, that's an expensive review. Thank you for that, Joseph.
You'll see what I'm talking about.
Okay, yeah, I haven't seen it. So, was it early 70s film?
Yes, 70. Yeah. Nathan, 72?
72. Yeah, okay, 72. This one I have to look out for. How about you, Eric? Have you seen anything of note?
I saw Dirty Dancing again.
Oh, yeah. Nathan, have you seen anything? No, Eric, what, anything of anything?
No, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I can't think of any new slashers. I've been catching up on lots of old ones, yeah, but... Not new.
Okay. How about you, Nathan? Is anything?
No, I watched The Collector the other night for the second time, and I still think it's mediocre at best. And that's at best. Okay. I'm not a fan of the torture movies that much. You know, I did like the first Saw, but The Collector, I don't know. For one, it is like you really have to suspend disbelief for this movie. Mm. I mean, it's really out there. Mm. And then, I don't know, like the characters make so many stupid decisions that I don't really care if they live or not. And
how
then,
about that alternate ending, though?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is the original ending I hate. I absolutely loathe how they ended it. But I watched the alternate ending on the DVD, and it was fantastic. I probably would have upped the rating by 3 or 4 points if they would have went with their original idea.
Right, because I saw the film, and I you know, agree. It was the whole torture porn is so over, and I didn't particularly like it when it was happening. And there were some good films, but I did like The Collector. I thought it was very silly, but I thought it was pretty good, and a very good use of Bauhaus track as well, I thought, being the old goth as I am.
Yes.
just quickly, one film I did see, which I would recommend with some reservations, is a Uruguayan semi-slasher film called Silent House, or The Quiet House, I can't remember, it's Silent House, and it's basically, it's a really strange movie, without giving too much away. It's the story of a man and his daughter go to a house in the middle of the countryside to basically get it ready for being sold, And when they're there, they settle down for the night, and then the daughter hears sounds upstairs and gets her father to go up and investigate. And she hears a struggle, and he's killed and upstairs, and she finds his body, and so she's trapped in the house with the killer, or so it seems. What's really interesting about the film is actually all shot in one shot. So from the beginning, when they're walking to the house, to being in the house, it all happening, it's all one single shot the whole way through.
Sort of any cuts. Like Rope?
Yeah, like Rope. But although Rope, I read that Rope was actually shot in 10-minute segments, and Hitchcock kind of made it look seamless, but it was actually shot in 10-minute segments. A bit like
with Halloween. The general idea, right?
The general idea, absolutely. And I'm not 100% convinced it's actually they're telling the truth with it. But what it does do, without giving anything away, is it throws in a twist, which is, if you've seen Haute Tension, you know, Strawberry Switchblade, not Strawberry Switchblade, that's its 80s reference. There,
yeah,
Eric. What's it called? High Tension and
Switchblade Romance.
That's the one. It has a similar twist, not the same twist at all, but a similar left of field twist, which worked much better in High Tension than it does in this film, which really doesn't work, I didn't think. But it's worth seeing if you get a chance. And it has already been remade for the American market with one of the Olsen sisters. So you can imagine how wonderful that's going to be. That's worth checking out.
I'd like to see it. It hasn't opened here though, unfortunately. No,
it was at the Art House Cinema. Like, so, and it was kind of it was on with sort of, it's kind of art house horror season in Bristol where I am. So that's worth seeing. It's not amazing, and the twist does kind of ruin it. But some great suspense sequences, and amazing how they managed to shoot it all in one shot, and actually keep it all, you know, not suddenly catch themselves on the camera with in a mirror with a camera or anything like that. So that's good. But any other films before we get on to our top three? I take that as a no. Okay. what we're going to do, I can't remember what I said in the intro, but we have the top three that we do each time. And this time we decided to do top three almost slashers, or films which aren't really thought of as slashers, but have an affinity to the slasher genre, i.e. they could be a thriller with slasher trappings, or even a comedy with slasher trappings, or whatever, but most people wouldn't think of them as slasher movies. So shall we start? Do you want to go first, Eric? What's your number three?
Okay, my number three is Dario Argento's 1985 film, Phenomena, which is not generally seen as a slasher film, although I think, to my mind, it is. It's... I suppose because it's so out there that people sort of skip it as being a slasher film. I mean, only Dario could come up with a movie where the final girl is not only the daughter of an international film star who's going to school in Switzerland. She has the ability to communicate with insects telepathically, but she also makes friends with an old professor who is in a wheelchair and has a chimp as a household helper. You know, I think all those things combined sort of mask the slasherness of the movie, when at its core it is about sort of this mutant killer child thing. And it opens very much in the style of a Friday the 13th type film with Argento's other daughter, not Asia. Is it Fiore or Fior? Would you pronounce it? Argento?
One of those, yeah.
Yeah, we meet her and she's lost. She's a student who's just missed her bus. She's lost in the middle of the Swiss Alps. She finds an old house. She goes inside, gets stabbed in the hands with scissors, gets decapitated. And, you know, that to me is very slasher-ish. I think a lot of people don't like Phenomena that much. The only problem I have with the film is the heavy metal score. This was the start of the Italian horror movie and heavy metal mashup that sort of progressed into films like Demons and Demons 2. But I mean, I think it's terrific. I would prefer it actually to Tenebrae, which is one that Argento fans seem to really like, but I think is one of his lesser works. So what would you think of Phenomena? Justin?
Yeah, well, no, it's not my favourite Argento movie by any stretch, but I think it's kind of, it's probably the tail end before he started getting really shit, basically.
for want of a better word.
For want of a better word is my but I, you know, I like it. It wasn't, you know, when you kind of seen some of his earlier films, and what I you know, my problem with Argento at that kind of time, and the same with opera, is that he completely lost his way. I mean, he's still making pretty good movies, but he was so desperate to have a hit that he was filling his films with heavy metal and music, which I just don't think works. Looking back on it, it's quite sort of cheesy now. It works for a film like Demons, but not for, you know, a film called Opera. You don't fill it with heavy metal and Phenomena.
Thank you.
Phenomena is, it couldn't have come from anyone else. I mean, it's incredibly loopy. The switchblade, the chimp with switchblade, and all of that stuff going on, and the massive pit with dead bodies in it. Where
yes,
what's her name? Who's the woman?
Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, I don't think she mentions that film anymore, does she? I don't think she was out. But anyway, it was.
She's too la-di-da for Phenomena.
Yeah, too la-di-da for Phenomena. But
no career opportunity, though.
No, exactly. I mean, just because it makes sense, I'll just go with mine next, just because mine's another Dario Argento film, and that's a film that I think, I mean, obviously, most people listening will know that the giallo is like the Italian slasher movie, basically. And a lot of people who like giallo but hate slashers are very offended if you talk about giallos as slasher movies. But that's what they are. I mean, they're not high art, most of them. They are, like slasher movies, they're done as crowd pleasers. But one of the films that is not often thought of as giallo or a slasher movie is Dario Argento's Suspiria. Now, on the face of it, it's not a giallo or a slasher movie, but when you look at it a little bit more closely, it starts with that fantastic double murder. You have a killer, or it could be supernatural. Well, it probably is supernatural, but you have a supernatural killer who is stalking a ballet school and killing the teachers or some of the teachers and the students there. A lot of it is done, especially the scene where the girl falls into the room full of razor wire, and she's being followed around the house by the killer. And I believe they have black gloves on, which is obviously a nod to the slasher and so the giallo. And to me, I've always wondered why that film is not seen more of as a kind of slasher or a giallo movie than it is. I mean, admittedly, it is one of my top five favourite films of all time, so I do love it. And I certainly don't see it as a bad thing to say that it's a slasher movie or giallo by any stretch. But I know Argento purists and some fans of Italian cinema would find it very offensive to say so. But I think it's basically a supernaturally tinged giallo come slasher movie, and it's all the better for it. So that's my number three. Do you guys agree?
I've never viewed Suspiria as a slasher.
I'm in the minority. I prefer Inferno, but I do love Suspiria.
Mm.
I like the ones y'all mentioned as well, but I prefer Opera. So.
Yeah. Opera's good. Opera's really good.
Well, it is.
But Opera, it has that heavy metal soundtrack, which I don't think. I think it kind of takes me out of the movie, and it has that strange ending. But really,
still though, it's got such great scenes in it. I don't know why. It's just some of my favorite scenes are in that movie. But Suspiria is terrific.
Mm.
I think it's an excellent film. I've seen it probably five or six times at least.
Yeah. Well, I think it'll be, maybe we should do a Dario Argento episode at some point, because I know some of the feedback we've had, you know, we've had at least one person asking us to do a giallo episode, and I'm very keen to do that at some point in the future. So, okay. Well, how about you, Nathan? What's your number three?
Well, this is... thanks to Amanda. You know her on the boards as Amanda by Night. She gave me this idea because she sent me a text message and gave us, you know, some decent feedback. She's been listening to the show, but she said, I got to give some love to Woodchipper Massacre. And she's right, because I do adore that movie. It's not a lot of people have seen it. I think a lot of people, when they turn it on, I mean, it's shot on video. They might see, oh, this is shot on video, and just shut it off right away. But it's really put together film for, you know, having a zero budget. I think that the writer director John McBride is really talented. It's basically about these three kids whose dad is going out of town on business, and he's got his sister, their Aunt Tess, to babysit them. And Aunt Tess is basically a complete bitch. I mean, she's rude, she's obnoxious. There's one classic scene where she's cooked this really disgusting casserole, and they're sitting around the dinner table before they eat, and she starts praying, and she's like, Save us from the power of Satan and from the dreadful thoughts that threaten to damn our immortal souls like maggots in a rotting and decomposing corpse. Amen. Now let's eat. and basically the story is the aunt like ends up getting killed. That's not really a spoiler because that's plastered all over the box for it. But and they have to hide the body. And of course, it's called Woodchipper Massacre. So, I mean, you can pretty much guess what they're going to do with her. Hmm. But her son, who is a criminal, has come into town and he wants his part of this money she's supposed to have for him. So, you know, they're trying to outwit him, and you know, basically the wood chipper obviously is going to come into play again. You know, it's definitely not a slasher movie, but you know, there's enough, you know, hacking and chopping going on that where I could still really enjoy it.
So Fargo kind of ripped that off then, huh?
Well, I don't know if I go that far, but now I have to admit though, the beginning seems a lot like that 90s comedy Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. I mean, it really is very similar.
I'm sorry.
I can't believe a film called Woodchipper Massacre is not considered a slasher.
It's just
I haven't seen this.
Like, there's not a big body count.
Mm. Okay. Well, I've never seen it. Is it one of those retro horror DVDs, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I believe, yes. Excellent. Well, thank you, Nathan. How about you, Joseph? What's your number three?
He's pure evil, pure power, pure terror. My number three is Rawhead Rex. By all accounts, this is a silly and extremely over-the-top movie, but there's just something about Rawhead Rex's stature and demeanor that kind of gives the film a certain menace. What you've essentially got is a 9-foot-tall demon running amok on the Irish countryside, and he's killing a bunch of incidental characters one by one. And the story itself is a jumbled mess of kind of pseudo-religious mumbo-jumbo, and the makeup effects on the Rawhead Rex character, they kind of switch from convincing to downright laughable in the blink of an eye. But on the other hand, you also have a scene where Rex, in the middle of the day, he throws a young son from the back seat of his car and kind of like devours him right in front of the helpless father's eyes. It's directed by George Pavlou. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Mm. It's kind of a Clive Barker short story that was adapted into a movie, and he had disowned it, but he's really got no one else to blame since he wrote the screenplay. It's at part times silly. It's at part times kind of scary, but it's really entertaining. And so that's my number three.
Excellent. Yeah, it's was it from Books of Blood, the Clive Barker short story?
I believe so.
Which are fantastic. If you've never read them, it's definitely worth reading. Of course, that's where
I read the Rawhead Rex short story about 15 years ago, which I admit is a lot better than the actual movie. But the movie is one of those films I saw when I was like maybe 5-6 years old. I don't remember first time I saw it. Maybe 10 or so. But I saw it like late at night, 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and then I had to kind of go to bed and kept thinking Rawhead Rex is just going to pound down my door. So it's always stuck with me.
With his latex fists.
Yeah.
With his latex fists. Yeah. I like and the ending. I also the music at the end.
Yeah, I also like that there's one scene in Rawhead Rex where he, instead of killing this pregnant woman, he kind of gets irritated that she's making this like big salad and it's got chunks of beef in it, so he starts smashing her kitchen like a dumb ape. It's really funny.
I'm gonna have to watch that. I haven't seen it for many years, but I have to watch it. It does sound like a bit of a laugh riot. So no, thank you Joseph. So how about you, Eric? What's your big number two?
My big number two. That's unfair to this film. It's something like The Exorcist 3. Now it's been a while since I've seen this film because I remember you saying, Justin, about April Fool's Day, you never purchased it on DVD because you were waiting in the vain hope that a special edition would come out. Mm. And that's what I'm doing with Exorcist 3 as well. I'm, you know, I have my fingers crossed that some kind of special edition with the original footage on the DVD will come out, but it never has. Mm. So I'm doing this off memory because I haven't watched it in quite a few years. But it's a film I really like, and it's more of a serial killer movie than it is an Exorcist sequel as such. And it's another one of those famous troubled productions that we were talking about with Scream 4, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about with Curtains later on. It focuses on Lieutenant Kinderman. He's the returning character from The Exorcist. He's played by George C. Scott, and he's investigating a series of killings that are going on in the area, and they seem to all, the forensic evidence indicates it's a different killer each time. But the modus operandi of the killer seems to indicate it's this deceased serial killer called Gemini. So it's kind of supernatural themed. And it's got the most fantastic shock sequence. I'm sure you know the one I mean. The cloaked killer.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
The cloaked killer with this, like, surgical shears. That would, you know, that would be right at home in a Jason movie or a Michael Myers movie. It's a stunning shock sequence that comes in the middle of quite a tranquil scene. The film does fall down. I know that because of studio interference. It's got that exorcism shoehorned in at the end that isn't needed, and it's really goofy. It's got sort of George C. Scott supernaturally pinned up against the wall, and you've got another priest melting into a ceiling, and it's all ridiculous. I remember reading the book it was based on, Legion, like a long time ago. I can't even remember the content, but I do remember really enjoying the book and finding the film to be completely different. But yeah, my number two is The Exorcist 3.
I'd love that movie.
I do too. It's brilliant. Really, really, really underrated, I believe.
I haven't seen it.
Haven't you?
No.
Wow, you should watch it. It's so good. I saw it actually at a film festival in 1990 when it, so no one knew anything about it. It was just it was a sequel to The Exorcist, so there was obviously a bit of, you know, interest in it. But when that that scene that Eric's talking about in the hospital corridor happens, there was a spontaneous round of applause from the audience because it's so effective.
That scene is shit your pants scary, I believe.
Yeah. Totally, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And on the big screen, you can imagine, because of the way it zooms in on what happens, is just kind of, it really, you know, gives me goosebumps thinking about it. And it's a sadly overlooked film, and it's fantastic. And you don't really need to have seen the other Exorcist movies.
No.
They're not, kind of stands on its own, I believe.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Nathan, you should, you know, definitely watch that. And anyone listening, if you've not seen Exorcist 3 Legion, then hunt it out, because it is fucking good. So, excellent. Well, thank you.
Watch your mouth.
Sorry.
Jesus will judge you yet again.
Well, talking of watching my mouth, I'm going to see if this works. This is my unusual number two.
Hello?
Is this the cocksucker residence?
God damn you, stop calling here.
Isn't this 4215 Pussy Way?
You bitch!
Now let me check the zip code. 212 fuck you!
The phone call scene from Serial Mom.
Oh!
Which yes. I know we're all fans of. And it kind of came to me. I remembered when I was putting this list together the other day, and I thought, Serial Mom, I've got to put that in, because if John Waters made a slasher movie, I was thinking, what would it be like? It would be like, as we talked last week about Psycho Beach Party. But of course, he has made a kind of slash movie, and it was Serial Mom with Kathleen Turner, which was, you know, I loved. Again, I think that was 1990 or 93, I think, when it came out. And I love John Waters movies, and Serial Mom is one of my favourites. It's probably the one I watched the most, and it's got endlessly quotable dialogue. And that scene with poor Dottie Hinkle on the phone with the psychotic Kathleen Turner, who, of course, goes round. What she do? She beats people to death with meat. She's set fire to teenagers. She stabs a teenager through the guts with a fire poker. So, to all intents and purposes, Serial Mom is a slasher movie. And I think it's an absolute joy. And I know you guys quite enjoy it.
Oh, I love it. Yes. You know the scene I like when she kills the boyfriend at the flea market.
Mm.
And then after she's done that, she goes out and sits with her daughter. And that random guy walks into the bathroom and does that scream that you hear in a lot of movies, but he's holding a shish kebab. Who takes food into a public restroom?
It's a John Waters movie, isn't it? I think that's going to be slightly.
And then there's the scene where, there's the scene where the guy that went to her husband's dentist to get his bridge on his teeth or something, or he had a bad molar, infected molar. They're sitting there eating this like bird, and they're like, and then it shows it right up close, and it's like all greasy and really gross. And she's just like horrified that they're doing this to this poor bird, and she just has to kill them.
Exactly.
Well, she kills them because they insult her husband.
Yes, she does. Because you said there's a scene where she says, now Dr. Sutphin says no more sweets, and then she gets that, oh, they're following my husband's orders, and he's like, eh, what does he know? And then she snaps, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of it's about as believable as the reveal for Scream 4, but we won't go to any spoilers. But all the better for it. So yeah, that was my number two. So
a good number two as well too.
Thank you very much. And how about you, Nathan? What's your number two?
They love their grandchildren. Well done. It's Rabid Grannies.
Rabid Grannies.
I have a huge love for this film. It's obvious. I mean, it's basically this really large, greedy family, and they have really two nice grandmothers, really kind, who are completely oblivious to their family's evil ways. And they gather at the two grandmothers' castle. They live in a castle for their birthday for the weekend. And one of the family members has been disowned because he's a Satanist. Well, he sends a box to them as a present, and it out comes this fog once they open it, and it transforms them into demons. So they're not really rabid, but basically they, you know, once they become demified, they start killing off their family members that whole weekend. So, I mean, I love it. It's got the whole, you know, my favorite kind of movie, which is why I love slasher so much. A large group of people trapped in a certain area getting killed off one by one. And that's my favorite kind of movie. So I really love this one. And if you get a chance, you need to see it with all the gore intact, because the version that I first saw is butchered beyond belief. Some death scenes, you can hardly tell what really happened to the people, but the uncut scenes are really awesome.
I saw Rabid Grannies at the cinema. I'm not sure if it's the same film festival that I saw Legion Exodus 3, which are very, very different types of movies, of course. But because it's Belgian, isn't it? I think it's a it's a Belgian movie. And so I haven't seen it for probably 20 years now. God, 20 years. Because I think it came out, was it 1990?
It's about then, yeah.
It was 1991. Mm. But yeah, so I haven't seen it since then, but it left made quite an impression. So it's kind of a horror comedy, isn't it? But it's kind of very, very grisly. So yeah, no. How about you guys? Have you seen it as well?
I did. I saw it when it was originally out on VHS, but I do remember not liking it quite a lot.
Right.
But it's something I could do and rewatch. I'm pretty sure as well, Nathan, that the version I saw was probably butchered beyond belief, because we are we are talking 1990 or 91. So I'll do my best to revisit it. Mm.
Excellent. Okay. Well, no, thanks, Nathan. That's a good number two. How about you, Joseph? Are you going to top us?
I don't know about topping, but
we won't go there.
Shut up. Yeah. Thank you. My number two is Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm.
A wonderful top, yes.
Yeah, you. You thought the bottom, you. Anyway, can I get into this?
Please? Yeah, go take it.
You can't really call it. I guess you can. You can't really get much more slasher-esque. I mean, I guess you can, but let's not say we did. You have Arnold Schwarzenegger and his group of commandos / political hopefuls in the middle of a jungle being killed off one by one by a rather nasty-looking creature who inexplicably wears fishnets and has a jawline that Susie's womanly parts after a day at the gynecologist. Kind of all boils down to the hulking creature fighting the hulking Schwarzenegger, mano a mano, beneath the jungle trees. And so, you know, Schwarzenegger, after all his men have been killed one by one, he sets up all these traps to try to corner the alien. He ends up cornering the alien, and the alien kind of sees right through his trap. So basically he's like, come on, come here, I'm right here. And yeah, that's it.
This one almost made my list as well.
It almost did, or it did.
I'm thinking about, you know, having ass sex with Arnold Schwarzenegger now, so it's
ruined. Joseph, I don't know where you got that from.
Yes.
You said he was a top guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, something about
this would have been bottom if it had made my list.
It would have been your bottom number three.
Mm.
Okay, yeah. Well, enough jokes about innuendo. Well, for the time being, anyway. So I think we're on to our number ones, aren't we? Mm-hmm. So Eric, do you want to?
Okay, my number one is controversially a film that I don't think is a slasher film at all.
Mm.
But the director insists it is his unique take on the slasher genre. It's a film I've mentioned a few times in the podcast already, and it is Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof, which is a film I really like. I was just thinking back when I was setting out this morning to go to Scream 4, I was trying to think of the last time I was really looking forward to going to the cinema to see something, and it was Grindhouse, which eventually didn't come out in the cinemas over here, as you know, Justin. It came in two parts.
Yeah.
So we got Death Proof on its own, first of all, and I have to say, it's my favourite Quentin Tarantino movie, and I think I'm probably the only person who thinks that. As I said, I don't think it's a slasher film, no matter how much he says it is. The only reason I'm throwing it in there is because I'm taking his word for it. It's just got the most spectacular car chase action in it, and there's a car crash in the middle that has to be seen to be believed. I mean, I can completely understand why people hate it, because it is basically women talking for long sections of the film.
Like The View.
That's what people were saying. It was like The View, punctuated with a car crash and maybe the odd car chase. I'd be interested to hear what your take is on it. But, I mean, it's a film I can rewatch over and over and over again. And I mean, as much as I love Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill and even Inglourious Basterds, this is the one Quentin Tarantino film that I actually own and that I can rewatch over and over again. And I think it's far superior to Planet Terror, which I also liked. But yeah, Death Proof is my number one non-slasher.
Okay, cool. How about you guys? What did you think of Death Proof?
I loved it. I like how you get the one set of girls and then you just kind of switch to the other set of girls. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
I also liked them kind of making Kurt Russell a whiny little crybaby at the end. He's like, they're shooting him and beating him.
Mm. Yeah. I think it has a terrific soundtrack as well, which is, you know, a common thread in all of his films, I suppose. Yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, I agree with you, Eric. I mean, I was disappointed when I originally saw it because I was thinking Quentin Tarantino is such a huge fan of slasher movies and genre movies, cult movies in general. I thought, you know, it'd be really interesting to see what he did. And I couldn't really get, I mean, the idea of a slash movie with a car. I mean, there have been slash movies, you know, Death Car and the Hearse and the Car and all these kind of films. But in reality, it just wasn't a slash movie. But I can understand why you chose it. And I bought on Blu-ray the Grindhouse.
Which I haven't watched yet.
Is that a shorter version or have they?
It is, yeah. The Grindhouse version runs about 90 minutes, whereas the standalone version is about 120.
Because that's the thing, to be honest. I do really enjoy Quentin Tarantino films, and a lot of the joy about his films are in the detail, you know. But any film that's 120 minutes is a little bit indulgent, I think.
I would tend to agree with you normally, but in this case, I can lap up every minute of the 120 of Death Proof. I mean, I can't pinpoint exactly what it is I love about it, because I'm not a Quentin Tarantino fanboy. I mean, I remember when... Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction were out during my college days, and you'd get all the students in there and there'd be a round of applause when his name comes up on the screen. And I wasn't one of those people, but I was blown away by Death Proof, and I'm pretty certain I'm the only one who was.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like we all quite liked it. I mean, I'm interested in seeing the shorter version because I may like it, because I know people who really liked his films and like love Kill Bill especially, and they went to see Death Proof and they were so excited to see it and they hated it. So, but I'm looking forward to seeing how it was originally meant to be done in the Grindhouse or the Blu-ray I've got. So, good choice.
It would be interesting to see what he would do with a real slasher script. Yeah. I'd say that would be quite good. If he was to take on maybe a Friday the 13th sequel.
He was down to
Halloween 6 at one stage.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, I think I'm coming up to my number one. I mean, it's not my favourite, but it's a film that kind of... it was toss-up between this and there's another film, Apartment Zero, which is one of my favourite thrillers, which is not a slasher movie by any stretch, but it's got Hart Bochner from Terror Train in it and Colin Firth, and as, you know, with Hart Bochner maybe a serial killer that's terrorising Buenos Aires, and Colin Firth is the kind of sexually confused man who is possibly losing his mind. And it's a really interesting film. If you've not seen it, you should see it. But it kind of flirts with the slasher genre a little bit, but more the thriller genre. But the film I decided to go with was a film that I saw very young, actually, probably in the late 70s, I probably saw this. And I remember, I think I may have seen a trailer for Halloween on TV, or I knew of it. And this film, I thought this is what Halloween was going to be like. And that film was Westworld, with the Yul Brynner sci-fi and Michael Crichton film, which again sounds like a really bizarre choice. But the reason for that, and if you've not seen Westworld, it's essentially a futuristic tale of a kind of amusement park where lifelike robots attend to every whim and sexual need and things like that. And there's different lands, like Roman lands, I think, and Westworld. And then things go wrong and the robots rebel. And Yul Brynner is a gunslinger who essentially goes wrong and then stalks one or two of the main characters relentlessly, even when his face comes off and it's all fizzing and everything's popping and there's circuit boards. He still goes, and I think he gets burnt at the end, and he just keeps going. He won't stop. And it's kind of, I've always looked back at that when I've looked at different slasher movies, especially Michael Myers. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if Westworld was a bit of a inspiration for that, the unstoppable boogeyman that John Carpenter created with Michael Myers. Yeah, so that's my number one.
Yes, good choice. Great movie.
I like Westworld. Really good movie. Yeah,
and the sequel, Future World, is good too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got that somewhere. I've got them both on VHS tape somewhere. But Westworld's one that sort of has always stuck with me. It's a film I saw at a young age, which I always thought that was, you know, it's not a slasher movie, but it reminded me of that, the unstoppable boogeyman, which kind of underpins almost all of the really good sort of 80s slasher movies. So,
can I just say something about your alternate choice, Apartment Zero? Mm. That is an awesome movie, and I would go gay for Hart Bogner in a heartbeat.
You go gay for a lot of guys, apparently.
Yeah. I would. I can't help it. Like Billy Zane. Billy Zane's hot. No.
Yeah, I know.
And Jensen Ackles, you were saying, talking about, weren't you?
James Gandolfini. Wait a minute.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, on that bombshell.
Okay. Moving on.
What's your one? Is it Torch Song Trilogy, Joseph? Is that your
what?
One? No,
what?
Sorry.
Torch Song Trilogy is your number one.
No, what's your real number one, Joseph?
Are we moving on to me?
Or Nathan, I mean, which you both got, I mean...
You go first. I'm still laughing over here. So
okay, Nathan, what's your number one?
Oh, well, my number one, this is the reason that Joe, I told him not to blab too much about it early on, is Terror at Red Wolf Inn.
Okay.
There we go.
What?
I said, now we dovetail back from the beginning.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
It was made in 72, and it's about a college student named Regina who is too poor to, you know, go on vacation when all her friends are going on vacation at college. And she gets a letter that she's won a free trip to the beach in this beach inn called the Red Wolf Inn. So she, very unwisely, they tell her she has to leave immediately, so she doesn't call anybody or tell them where she's going. She just hops in a plane and flies out there. And once she gets there, it's ran by these really two nice, friendly older couple and their mentally handicapped grandson, who's, you know, probably in his 20s, and he takes a liking to her. Well, you know, anybody that's seen more than just a few horror movies knows that something's not right with the old couple, especially when they spend all the time trying to fatten their guests up. And then once their guest reaches a certain weight, they suddenly leave the next day without saying goodbye to anybody. So, you know, they're obviously cannibals, and they're planning on fattening Regina up, but it all takes a different turn when the grandson ends up liking her and doesn't want to kill her. So, you know, it's a really interesting movie, and I love the fact that the elderly couple are just so nice as they go about their killing business. I mean, there's one scene where the grandson's trying to tell them he don't want to kill Regina, and he says, "I really like her. Like, I really like her. You understand?" And the grandmother's like, well, I like her too. She's very sweet. You know, she's still planning on killing her regardless.
Sweet tasting.
Yeah. And it's got a great ending, which I won't spoil because I know y'all haven't seen it, but I love the way the movie ends. It's like, you know, it makes you think it's going to go one way and then it goes in the completely opposite direction. So I think it was way ahead of its time.
Is it prefigure Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Yes.
By a year.
By a year. Okay.
Two years. 2 years. 2 years.
2 years, actually.
Yeah. Yes, 2 years. I saw this movie, a couple weeks ago for the first time?
After I've been trying to get you to watch it for like 10 years?
Yeah, and I really, 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 really liked this movie a lot. The one thing I really liked about this movie is that the lead girl, she is the most likable, down-to-earth, like, female lead that I've probably ever seen in any horror film. I mean, I really wanted her to kind of get through this kind of torment that she's having put on her. And like Nathan said, it has a really surprising ending. Even though I guessed it about 30 minutes in, I guessed it and I was right. It's still surprising the way they set it up. And, you know, all the characters are likable. It's filmed really well. It's got this disjointed kind of kooky 70s vibe to it that I really liked. I really recommend this movie. It's really good.
Excellent. I've not seen it. How about you, Eric? Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it either, but I'm definitely going to have to seek it out now.
Yeah, excellent. Well, thank you, Nathan. And how about you, Joseph? Are you going to wrap up with your number one?
Yeah, my number one is Rob Zombie's Halloween.
oh, I love that film.
It's not a slasher movie. That is a slasher movie.
No, it's not. it's a Jerry Springer episode masquerading as a slasher.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah. My number one is... probably the only thing to make David Caruso look competent at Session 9.
Okay, yeah, yes. Fantastic movie.
A seriously, seriously creepy and disturbing film about an asbestos removal unit called in to clean out an old abandoned mental hospital. Needless to say, when they get there, strange things happen. One of which is this disembodied voice that's later revealed by way of session recordings from the old hospital to be someone named Simon, who may or may not be one of nine personalities of a woman named Mary. At this point, the workers kind of begin to vanish one by one until a blood-soaked finale where we finally get a somewhat vague idea as to who's killing these guys off one by one. This film, what it does is it, rather than, you know, doing boo scares, it kind of uses sound effects or creepy music and kind of creaking sounds of the old building to kind of heighten atmosphere, or it kind of hints that there might be danger when there's not, or it hints that everything is okay when there's danger right around the corner. And the characters are likable. $100 guys. The voice of Simon is really fucking terrifying, and it was actually recorded by a woman, and they kind of did a pitch shifter on her voice, so it's like, "Hello, Doc." I can't really do it, but you can do this.
Yeah, that wasn't too scary.
That wasn't very scary, was it?
Oh, come on, you're shaking in your boots. I'm sorry, in your underwear.
You're the one that said you were dressed in your underwear for this thing. Okay. Yeah, I'm wearing an Armani suit.
I'm dressed to kill. No, this is a really, really good movie, and I saw it kind of came out of nowhere. I think it was Alt Horror. Someone from Alt Horror was like, "If you need to see a good movie, check out Session 9." And I was like, "Okay." So I watched it and I was like, "Wow, that was really, really terrifying in spots. A really good movie."
That is really. I love Session 9. It's a great. I love slash movies for, you know, obvious reasons. That's why we're doing this. But I do love kind of slow burn, kind of those kind of creepy type films. And Session 9 is really creepy. It's just so well done. Another film that I saw recently, which I know you've seen, Joseph, which reminds me of Session 9, is the Australian Lake Mungo.
Oh, yes. Lake Mungo is fantastic.
Which is a fantastic film, which is really
scary. That movie
scary.
Terrifies me.
Yeah.
It's really scary.
Really scary.
Find out what happened at Lake Mungo, I about jumped out of my chair.
Yeah. The camera footage.
I might have soiled myself a little on that one.
Well, there you go. Listeners, that's a shopping list of films for you to go and see. But lots of worthy things there to additions. But if you haven't seen them, then do. So should we wrap that up, guys? And should we get on to, I can't remember what we're going to talk about next. Are we going to talk about feedback, or are we going to go on to our feature presentations?
I got a little bit of feedback.
Yeah, feedback now.
Actually,
okay.
Nathan got some feedback.
Oh, yeah, you did, didn't you?
Yeah. A girl named Danielle sent us an email saying she lives in a small town, and, you know, her favorite things to do to while away the hours are listen to heavy metal music, you know, more power to her, and watch horror films, especially slasher films. Now, she has a thing for guys with really strong Southern accents, and she thinks Nathan is a cutie pie. So
There well, hello, Danielle.
How you doing, baby?
I appreciate that. That makes me blush a little bit. I'm getting a little flustered here.
Oh. I'm sure she'll like that when she listens in. Yeah. If she hasn't, you know.
You haven't scared her off.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Because I sent her nude photos of you. And that might scare her off. I won't tell you how I have nude photos of you, but
yeah,
I do.
Yeah, I was about to say, how exactly did you get them? Are you like outside my window snapping pictures when I'm dancing in front of the mirror?
I'm not saying.
Oh, dancing in front of the mirror like the girl in Troll 2.
I like to dance like her, yeah.
Oh, my God!
Well, maybe sorry. Danielle will come round and bite off your little nuts and eat them. Anyway, so feedback. I'm sure Danielle won't mind. Any other feedback? I've got a few bits here from people. Shall I just run through them? We were a bit confused with the iTunes and reviews. And if you haven't reviewed your podcast and if you've got something nice to say about it, please get on there and give us a review, because that's how people find podcasts. And what it seems is there's different iTunes in different countries. Like there's one in England, one in Ireland, and one in America, which is why we were a bit confused about why we couldn't see them. But one in England that I've seen is from Miles Schmiles. I don't know if it's his real name. And he says, a charming and almost scarily well-informed podcast concerning all celluloid slashers. The sheer range of films discussed in a good-humoured but affectionate manner is limb-hackingly impressive. Beware spoilers, however. Obviously not for Scream 4. And recommended for all horror fans. So thank you, Miles, for that feedback. One thing I did get on Twitter and I am one of those people that probably annoying that Scream 4 is making fun of, but Mark Huckle was very upset, Eric, that you called him Mick Hucknall the last episode.
Sorry.
So, no, he wasn't really.
Mick says, Hucknall?
Mick Hucknall.
Yeah. I thought you said Mick Hucknall. It's your accent.
Okay. Well, he says, thanks for the mention on the podcast. Even if you did call me Mick Hucknall. Ha ha. Another classic. Look forward to the next one. And then we also have from Miles I. Hammer, which could be Miles Schmiles, I don't know. Maybe there's two Miles listeners. It says, book bought, which is Teenage Wasteland, available at all good bookshops, as long as you're in England. Website read and podcast downloaded. Love it. Slowly corrupting my eyeballs of your grisly tuition. Cheers. And the last one I've got is Count Fosco, who we've mentioned before. And he's been buying films to watch them along with the podcast. And he said about 30, talking about, we did Death Screams last episode, he said about 30 odd minutes into Death Screams and finding it far more fun than Graduation Day and Mortuary already. What a relief. I think he was a bit worried that we were choosing turkeys.
But he's a smart man.
He's a smart man, yes. Although I must say, I'm not sure if Death Screams is more fun than Graduation Day. But
no. Hey.
Different strokes.
I'm with Justin on this one, yeah.
I'm with Justin on this one, too.
Oh, yes. What? What about Ramona?
I love Ramona, I do. But, I mean, Graduation Day, I have like a thing about Graduation
Day.
Mortuary
as well.
Yeah, fuck all of you, I'm out of here.
Yeah, all right. Don't hear your ass on the way out, love. okay, so, right, anyway. Sorry?
What did you just say?
I didn't say anything. Okay, so we move on to our feature presentation.
Well, I got a bit of feedback. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah, sorry, Eric.
It's from Paul Chandler, who lives near London. He said, I just wanted to say that I've listened to all of the first podcast and really enjoyed it. It was great. One thing I will disagree with Justin was the assumption that he made that you'd only be listening if you knew the films being discussed. Being a horror slasher fan who hasn't got past much of the obvious faves like Halloween, Friday the 13th and Scream, I find it fascinating hearing about films I've not yet seen, especially obscure faves. Happy Birthday to Me sounded creepy and stupidly great. So there we go.
Thank you for that feedback. Yes, we'll take it on advisement. So,
should I go ahead and give out the email address again?
Yeah, please do. Thank you, Joseph.
All right, that is the what do you call them? Full stops.
Full stops.
Full stop. Hysteria. Full stop. Continues at gmail.com. Send what you have. Hate mail. Love letters. Can you send back those nude photos of Nathan? I kind of lost mine.
It's a full stop.
It's a dot, like a period.
Come on, we're an international podcast, Nathan. You've got to get with the program. Yeah. Okay.
You didn't even know what there's a Jesse on the phone meant.
I didn't know what that meant either. Okay, so I got to be educated to all this. Do y'all know what shucks means?
We don't know what it means to eat a zucchini on the sidewalk.
No. This is the Queen's English, boys, so not your made-up funny
I tell you, I'm going to talk like this for the rest of mine. Do my best Southern accent. That's kind of how
that's
those lame. People...
When are you going to start doing the accent, Joseph?
I'm sorry?
When are you going to start doing the accent?
What am I going
to
start?
Yeah, really?
Yeah, it didn't sound any different to me. Anyway, let's...
Ooh.
Shall we move on with our feature presentation? Mm-hmm. We're going to start, as I said earlier, we've got two films. We've got Canadian Double Bill coming up, and we're talking to the lovely Leslie Donaldson later. But first of all, we're going to talk a little bit about this film.
Behind every curtain, someone is waiting. Someone is watching. Someone is hiding. What waits behind the curtains is exciting, frightening, sensual, terrifying, bizarre. Curtains reveal what you expect and what you don't. Ultimate nightmare.
And judging by how long it took to film and release the film, it was an ultimate nightmare for some people. I'm just going to read, in case you've not seen the film, again, we probably will have spoilers because we tend to do spoilers just so we can talk about the whole film. So we'll try and we'll say when we're doing the spoilers, we'll try to. But this is off IMDb, is a little summary synopsis if you don't know the film. Samantha Sherwood has worked with the well-known director Jonathan Stryker on all his major films. She naturally assumes she's been given the title role of the latest venture, Audra. He tells her that she needs to do some background research on the part, so arranges to have her committed to an asylum as Audra is a former psychiatric patient. She goes along with this, not realising that he intends to leave her there indefinitely and audition six young women of various professions for the part instead. She finally manages to escape and returns to the spooky old mansion where the auditions are taking place. But who is causing the disappearances of the young hopefuls? Is it Samantha? Is it Stryker? Or is it one of the actresses willing to kill for the coveted part? Just who is the killer behind the old hag mask? So that is Curtains, which was began shooting in 1980 after success of Prom Night. I say it's a Canadian film by Peter Simpson, as a producer of Prom Night, wanted to do another slasher film to follow up Prom Night, which would have been a big success. But it turned out to be a complete nightmare. And just a little bit of behind-the-scenes stuff, which we'll be talking to Leslie in a minute about. The Belgian-born cinematographer, Richard, I don't know how to pronounce it, it's Kupka, could be Cupcake, I think it's Kupka, was hired to film in 1980, and it was meant to be a supernaturally tinged slasher with a 500-year-old banshee doing the killing. And in fact, makeup effects were done by someone called Greg Canham, but never actually used. Now, and also Klaus Kinski was earmarked to play the part that John Vernon does, who's the director Jonathan Stryker. What happened was the film was shot and completed, and then Peter Simpson saw it and hated it. It was much more deliberately placed, like a European-type thriller is how I've seen it described. Simpson apparently was notorious for ordering reshoots on films. And in fact, actors, which I think Leslie talks about in a minute, were wearing T-shirts saying another Simpson or Simcon, which was the company, reshoot. So what happened, there was 2 weeks of reshoots, which I believe took place in 1982. So almost 2 years after the film had wrapped, or, certainly a long time after it wrapped. Simpson himself shot 2 weeks of reshoots, spicing up the murders and making it as much like Prom Night, i.e. a Halloween ripoff, as he possibly could. The film, if you've seen the film and you look at the credits, it's got Act 1 and Act 2, which alludes to a kind of theatre-type style presentation. But Act 1 is Kupka's film, and Act 2 is Simpson's reshoots. The film wasn't released into screens until March 83, which was pretty much almost three years after it started shooting. Not until Canadian screens until the September that year. So, guys, what did you think of it? Eric, do you want to go first?
Curtains is a favourite of mine. I think the big plus of it is it has a fantastic killer's disguise, that really creepy old hag's mask. It also has one of the most suspenseful sequences in a slasher film, and that's, of course, the ice skating sequence where Leslie Donaldson is on a frozen pond skating to her ghetto blaster, if you can remember what they are. And she's, basically this hag-masked killer skates towards her in slow motion in broad daylight, and it's quite a tricky thing to make a broad daylight scene like that kind of creepy, but like this scene is incredibly creepy. I also love the characters in it. Some of them are underdeveloped, but the lead character of Jonathan Stryker, that's his name, Jonathan, played by John Vernon, he's such a sleazebag. It's fantastic. He beds two of the actresses that come up to do the auditions, and he when he's not bedding them, he's getting them to do these acting workshops where they have to seduce each other and take off each other's clothes. It's absolutely fantastic. I'm sure it's every straight man's ultimate dream job. The studio interference aspect is quite apparent in certain scenes. Samantha escapes from an asylum, but we don't get to see how she escapes. She has this dialogue with this unseen person who has their back to the camera about how they helped her escape and how she's going to go up to the remote house and get her revenge or whatever. And also, there's a weird thing where the most underdeveloped character kind of ends up as the final girl. That's the character, I think her name is Tara, and she has this big long chase sequence in towards the end, where she crawls into a vent and all that, and it goes on for about 15 or 20 minutes. But it's weird because up until that point, we haven't really seen anything of her. And I think that is probably the biggest indication that things were not quite right, behind the scenes. But on the whole, I think, for a film with such a troubled production, it's really quite a success, and certainly one of my favourites of the era.
No, I agree. How about, what do you think, Joseph?
Before I say anything, they actually filmed the other version with Klaus Kinski. Was it done?
No, I don't think he was actually in it. I think he was earmarked. I mean, maybe he did. I don't know.
There's another version with like a 5,000-year-old banshee killing people.
Well, that's my understanding. Yeah.
I'd like to see that. Yeah. That sounds awesome.
It does sound awesome, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds, from what I can tell. This is going from stuff that I've read, and I mean, how obviously believable the internet is, and you have to take everything with a pinch of salt, but. Apparently, all the makeup effects were done for this banshee, but it obviously wasn't what Peter Simpson wanted, which was basically a prom night follow up, although a more mature cast, and he wanted another slasher movie. And my understanding is there is out there somewhere sitting in a box is the original Curtains. And we would love to see it, but we haven't even got a decent, there's not even a decent version of Curtains out on DVD. And if there will be, I don't know. But So what were you going to say, Joseph?
The Leslie trifecta, I'd say this is my favorite of her three.
Okay.
Even better than Happy Birthday to Me.
Wow.
I'm sorry, were you saying something?
No. No, I was going to say, I would say that I prefer Happy Birthday to Me to Curtains.
Oh, okay.
Different strokes and all that.
We're kind of together. Are you still talking?
No. I'm
tongue-tied today.
No, sorry, I'm having a few Skype problems. If you're listening, we're doing this over Skype, so there's sometimes a few little dropouts or us finding difficulty understanding each other, so just bear with us. But sorry, Joseph, carry on.
All right. I think my favorite scene outside of the ice skating sequence is probably the ending, which I'm going to spoil. It turns out the killer is Patty, played by Lynn Griffin. She ends up killing the heroine, and at the very end, you know, she's basically this stand-up comedian, and she kind of wants to be taken seriously as an actress. And at the end, she gets her wish. She finally gets to do a one-woman stage performance of Audra. But unfortunately, she has to do it in front of a bunch of mental asylum inductees, or whatever you want to call them. She's basically in this insane asylum performing this Audra scene in front of a bunch of, you know, doped out, kind of hanging their head like, ugh. It's a really stark ending to a really kind of stark movie, I think. It fits. And, you know, with all the production troubles, apparently, I thought that, you know, for the most part, the movie was kind of seamless for having production problems.
Yeah. I mean, I liked all the theatrical swish of the curtains cutting across the screens and stuff like that. I mean, that was visually, it's great. And of course, you know, just very quickly, before I forget, is that whole weird thing with the doll, you know, the doll that pops up, which is kind of
Scene where the doll's in the rain in front of the car, that was really creepy as well.
Well, that's really creepy, and it's also it hints at, not, although dolls aren't supernatural necessarily, but the very fact is that that kind of one thing seems to hint that there may have been at one point part of the film had a supernatural tinge to it, because the doll reach out and grab the woman, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then the car drives up and sort of kills her, and obviously they you know, unless the killer has got like an amazing animatronics background, then there has to be some supernatural reason for that. So, but it's fascinating to try and work out what is, you know, what is part one, act one, and act two. And if you look at the credits, I mean, it looks like the whole of Canada worked on this film. I mean, it's a massive amount of people working on this film.
I mean, you know, for all the production problems they say they have, you know, for me, I thought, wow, you know, there are a few instances in the film where you can tell it was shoddily edited or it was rushed in one scene. But for the most part, I think it kind of flows together quite nicely.
Yeah. Excellent. How about you, Nathan? What's your take on curtains?
It's interesting that y'all mentioned the scene where the doll grabs one of the victims, because that ends up being a dream sequence, and then we cut to her getting killed in her apartment like really quickly, and it seemed kind of rushed. So I bet that the scene where the dog grabs her, that was probably the original death scene for her character. But then I guess they used it as a dream sequence when they re-edited the movie. I wonder if that's what happened.
That's what I was thinking as well, when I was watching it.
Yeah. Did you like the movie, Nathan?
Oh, I love Curtains. I think it's an excellent movie, despite all the problems that they had. I know the ice skating scene gets, you know, a lot of praise, and deservedly so. It's a really great scene. And I love the killer makes this noise every time she's coming down with that sickle. It's like, huh, you know,
like a big whoosh. Yeah.
I like that that noise that's being made in those scenes. But to me, one of the scenes, and, you know, Eric mentioned it, that doesn't get a lot of talk, which I think is really well done, is the scene in the prop house, the big stalking sequence in the prop house. I thought, you know, I was on the edge of my seat during that whole entire stalking sequence. So, I mean, I really liked that scene as well. But of course, I'm a big fan of chase scenes anyway. And the ending, Joe's already spoiled it, so, you know, it won't matter what I say, I guess. I kind of was disappointed that, I mean, I understand, you know, Patty was the killer, and I love Lynn Griffin, and she did an excellent job. But for some reason, I felt it would fit the movie more if Samantha was the killer. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know. I would like that ending better for some reason.
See, I like it with Patty. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I like it with Patty because it's so unexpected, I think. That was one of the movies I didn't guess who the killer was. And I'm usually fairly good at guessing who the killer is, but I did not with this one.
I guess to me it just seems like too big of a coincidence that at the end there's two murderesses in the kitchen together because they both killed people.
Yeah. I was going to say Lynn Griffin, of course, was the symmetry there. She was the first victim in the original Black Christmas, wasn't she? She was in that film. I mean, I think we're talking about like the different versions of this, and on the UK release, on the video release when it came out, the one I've got, I think we may have mentioned this. And we probably might talk about it with Leslie, but we say that on the back of the video box there's a picture from the original version, which isn't in the film, which is of all the actresses dead sat around on chairs on the stage with a woman stood in the middle with her arms outstretched with red hair, which would be likely to be Lynn Griffin's character. But the photo is so indistinct, it's quite difficult to make it out. But it's tantalising to think that there was, you know, there is this completely different version of this film floating around somewhere. And it would be, you know, if someone would pick it up and release it in a decent version with both versions on, you know, double disc, I mean, that would be amazing. I mean, if films like, you know, Nightmares in a Damaged Brain and other films, which, you know, I they're great, but they're not as good as Curtains, can get, you know, amazing releases, then certainly a film the quality of Curtains should get a bit of that love.
I just want to say there is one disappointing aspect of the hot tub sequence. It's not as cheesy as it could have been. It's when Jonathan Stryker is kind of looking down at the window at this couple in the hot tub, and they're just kind of circling the hot tub. And I kind of wanted bigger hair, more splashing, more melodramatic music, but what can you do?
I guess if it'd been made a little bit later in the 80s, you might have had, because obviously Mad Men has that that wonderful.
Yes, that's what I was referencing.
Yes, I know that's what you were referencing.
Yeah. And this, the other film.
That's
the film,
Nathan's favorite movie.
I don't like that movie.
You don't like that movie?
I don't like Mad Men.
Oh, okay. Well, that's one for us to cover at some point, isn't it? I mean, I was going to say.
Coming up next, Mad Men.
I was going to say about Mask, and the Mask of the Killer, which is so effective. Is the two films reminding me, obviously, one was Terror Train, which is another Canadian slasher movie, obviously, with the conductor's mask, but also The Comeback, which I don't know if you guys have seen it. It's Pete Walker who did the British slasher movie.
Yep. Good movie.
And it's a great movie, but the killer wears a very similar hag mask in that, and that was made in 1978. So I'm not saying, you know, but I mean, obviously, slasher movies have got a uniquely magpie tendency where they do.
But the killer, things. I'm sorry, Justin. I was just gonna say the killer uses a sickle to kill in that scene in The Comeback too.
Yeah, that's when The Comeback is. I like The Comeback. It's not. There's not enough slashing going on. But that scene where the killer comes down the stairs in a hag mask with a sickle running down the circular stairway is quite alarming, and it's really well done. If there'd been more of that, The Comeback would have been less of just Jack Jones, whatever it is, and more of the killer, then would have been much better. But I just wondered if that was what has influenced. And interestingly, that obviously that the killer in the hag mask is obviously probably an addition to the original movie. That the killer in the hag mask probably wasn't in the original movie. The version, if it was this 500-year-old banshee. It'd be amazing to see that. And I mean, for my money, I really like Curtains. I think it's really interesting because it's got that so atypical. I mean, Leslie probably is the youngest person in the cast, and they make reference to that, I think, and they saying, why is she here? She's only a baby. Whereas the rest of the cast are mostly women in their 30s and 40s. And that creates an interesting dynamic, and the movie's got some really fun bitchy dialogue, and there's the other kind of, well, a mystery, but the thing that was put around was that a woman called Celine Lomez was originally cast in the role of Brooke Parsons, and she's replaced by Linda Thorson, ostensibly because Celine Lomez wouldn't do nudity, although the irony, obviously, the film doesn't actually have any nudity. But what Peter Simpson subsequently said, is my understanding, was that Celine Lomas couldn't act, or they weren't happy with her performance, so they replaced her with Linda Thorson, who, you know, I think is really good in the movie. One of my favourite scenes is when she's having that chat with her very camp agent. And, you know, they, you know, talking about going, you know, she's pretty much almost got the part of Audra. So I think it's, you know, it's a fantastic idea. And considering how troubled it was for a film that was shot over 3 years with two different directors, and it was all changed to be more commercial. And the irony actually was that the time, you know, if Curtains had come out at the tail end of 1980, or probably when it was shot late in 1980 originally, if it had come out in the beginning of 1981, it probably could have been a relatively big hit. Because the slasher movies weren't really bombing at the box office you know, until sort of later in 81. You know, I think My Bloody Valentine was probably one of the first ones to not do very well, and that was February 81. But Curtains certainly would have had a better chance of making a lot of money at the box office if it hadn't have limped out in 1983, which, as we all know, was the slash movie, bar films like House on Sorority Row were pretty much dead in the water. So, you know, I think it was, for what it is, it's a very good film and still highly entertaining. It's a real shame there's not a better version of it out there for people to see. Because I think if it was in a nice widescreen presentation, the kind of the snowy landscapes and certainly the scene, the celebrated scene with Leslie on the ice skating, which is probably easily in my top 10 of slasher movie moments, of any slasher movies that I've ever seen, I'm sure that would look absolutely amazing. So have we got anything else we want to say about this, guys, before we go on to Leslie's interview?
Can I just ask about the inclusion of the actor Michael Wincott in there? Because he doesn't seem to do anything except swirl around the hot tub with a girl and then get killed off screen. So I'm wondering if he was... if he had more to do in the original script, I wonder, and I think was cut out, because he seems superfluous to it.
My understanding, I think it's him who has a death scene on screen where a snowmobile comes smashing through with him on it into the house. I think it was him that I read about. Whether that was in what they were intending to do or not. I mean, the irony, actually, thinking, so talking about actors being in and not being in it, and Klaus Kinski, of course, just touched on Schizoid, which is in a film that doesn't ever really get spoken about, but that has a murder in a hot tub as well. So there's all these kind of 7 degrees of 6 degrees, whatever, Kevin Bacon for, you know, Friday 13th reference there, but with all these different things going on. And so, but I, you know, agree, Eric, I think it probably is. There's probably is a box somewhere with lots of trimmings from this film. Yeah, it would be interesting to see.
I wonder if there's more footage of that asylum inmate who has the insatiable desire to tickle her fellow inmates.
I love that the way that the slasher movies do that kind of, so it was a bit like the inmates in The Initiation.
Yeah.
Which, and my favourite of, obviously, we talked about with my guilty pleasure, with the inmate in Straight Jacket who washes their hair in the bird bath. And so it's kind of like, it's not exactly Francis, you know, that the film based on the 1940s starlet with Jessica Lange, where she has a frontal lobotomy, which I think is probably quite a realistic portrait of an asylum, the time in asylum. But slash movies don't tend to really go for realism when they come to asylums, do they?
Let me ask you, Eric. I can't really remember, but is that the same Michael Wincott who plays a bad guy out more often than not now, and he kind of talks now?
Yeah, that's him exactly.
Yeah, I thought that was him. I was like, what is he doing in this
Crow
movie?
I know. Yeah, I don't. He's doing nothing. He comes and sits at the table.
Strange Days.
Yeah.
And Metro with Eddie Murphy. He played a bad guy in that. He's a really good bad guy, I think. I think he'd make a good slasher villain.
Should have been him in the end, yeah.
Well, maybe it was in one of the original cuts. It's difficult to know, isn't it? So,
they have like 50 versions. He was the killer in 4 of them.
Yes.
Well, we did. Unfortunately, we tried to get in contact with Lynn Griffin, didn't we? But we didn't hear back from her. We heard bits and pieces back from her. But it'd be lovely. It'd be great at some point. Because when we approach people for interviews, we don't always get a response straight away. In fact, it could be months afterwards. And I've got a couple in the pipeline that hopefully can talk about some podcasts films we've already covered, but we'll kind of slip those in as it were.
Yeah, you're being rude again now. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I live for the double entendre. Anyway, I said Arnold Schwarzenegger is allegedly a top. So that seeks us nicely into no, it doesn't seek us nicely into at all. But anyway, I'm trying to change
stop
the subject
it, stop
into the interview. So we can always come back to Curtains, but I think now's an apt time to maybe chat with one of the certainly my favourite final girl ever. We're going to talk about her turn as a final girl after this. And
we love you, Leslie.
We love you, Leslie. And yes. Here we all had the pleasure of chatting with the lovely Leslie Donaldson.
What are you doing?
Come on, I want a picture of your beautiful bar. It's for my locker door.
Why don't you buy yourself a pitcher of Farrah Fawcett?
We have a special treat for everyone today. From Happy Birthday to Me, Funeral Home, and Curtains, and Deadly Eyes, we have Leslie Donaldson, who has graciously agreed to let us pick her brain today. Welcome, Leslie.
Hello.
All right. With the ball rolling, I'm going to ask you a question, and then the other three will kind of like follow suit. So is that all right with you?
It sounds good.
All right. I'm going to ask you a simple question. Were you ever approached for like any other subgenre films, like any other slasher films back in the early 80s?
Actually, I auditioned for, I think it was Humongous.
Wow, really?
Yeah, which was, I want to say it was Bill Fruitt as well who did that, but I could be wrong.
It was Paul Lynch.
Paul Lynch, yes, it was Paul Lynch. I remember that. I mean, you have to remember, this is like 30 years ago, so the who's and the what's are kind of a fuzzy. But, I do remember auditioning for that. And I think there was another Bill Fruitt film that I was asked to audition for, but I can't remember what it was. And also, actually, I was up for the part of Mary Lou in the Prom Nights sequel, the part of Mary Lou. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was kind of exciting. But it went to Lisa Schrag, who played that part, and well, I might add. So she was great.
Can you imagine what a Prom Night 2 would have been like with you in the lead? I think that
would have been fun. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. All right, Justin?
Yeah, well, it's actually leading on from that, Leslie. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved with Funeral Home? And also, I always wondered, I watched it the other day, and why you were so scared of that cat.
Well, I have cats. I love cats. So I don't know. It was written in the script that the character was afraid of the cat. So, and I do have a black cat, and her name is Mina, and I love her. You know, she's amazing. But how I got involved with Funeral Home is basically the writer of Funeral Home was Bill Fruitt's wife, Ida, and the producers of Funeral Home had just one of the producers had just done Meatballs. She had written Meatballs with two other writers, and Barry Allen was producing it, and his daughters were involved. So I went in and auditioned, and I guess I was just the right quality they were looking for the part at the time. So I was fortunate enough to get it. So it was just, there was no like magic, you know, formula for it. It was just luck of the draw, basically. And I was 15 at the time, and they were looking for a young girl. And the script is basically, you know, Little Red Riding Hood meets Psycho. And so I got the role. It was great. And the character was basically this young timid girl who goes to her grandmother's house, and there's this cat, and you know, you're supposed to think the cat is, you know, like the fortuitous you know, thing through, but I mean, basically it's the one thing that saves her at the end. So it all fell into place basically for me.
Fantastic. Well, do you say you were 15 when you made it, or were you 15 when you were cast?
I was 15 when I actually filmed it. Yeah,
oh, okay.
It was the summer of 79, and I was 15. That was so long ago. Oh my God, I'm dating myself.
Excellent. Thank you, Leslie.
Years ago. Yeah, I was 15.
Excellent. I was just going to say, I didn't, you know, if you knew, but I think the cat was called Mittens.
It was. Mittens was the name. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
you're right.
Cats as well.
The least threatening cat name ever.
Yes, it was.
Exactly.
Excellent. Thank you, Leslie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I'll follow up with a question on Funeral Home. If you say you were only 15 when you filmed it, so was it a big deal then going back to school and telling all your friends you had this lead in this movie?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it actually, it fell between the vacation, the summer vacation. So I filmed it in the summer of 79. So yeah, absolutely. you know, I was never one to sort of play up what I was doing outside of school, because I was just, you know, it was just what I did. And, you know, I didn't go to school and go, I'm in a movie. You know, that's not my style. So, and the other kids really, you know, they just, I mean, when I had work, I would, you know, I would be absent from school that day, and nobody really, you know, paid any attention until later. But, you know, the film didn't come out until, I believe, 81 or 82. So I was in high school then. I was just starting high school before I filmed it. So it all kind of worked out where I was, you know, I finished, you know, middle school, I did the film, and then I was moving into high school, so nobody really paid attention to, you know, and Keanu Reeves was at the school too, so it was like,
oh wow,
nobody, you know, like, yeah, it was no big deal. Not that he was Keanu Reeves then, but you know, it was before all that happened for him, but yeah.
And I heard the film was a big hit in Mexico, and you became a screen queen there.
Apparently so. That's what I heard too.
Yeah,
exciting.
Okay, Nathan?
Yeah, Nathan, what do you have?
I was just wondering, what was it like working with Bill Frewett?
Bill Frewett, to me, was great. I liked him a lot. I know Kay Hawtrey had trouble with him, but I thought he was great. You know, he was, you know, when you're a young actor, you just, you know, you go with the flow, you know, most of the time. So I didn't have any, I wasn't like looking for any kind of trouble. I didn't know there was any trouble. I showed up, I did my stuff and called it a day. But, I know that, you know, years later, Kay and I became friends, and she would tell me the kind of traumas she was having on the set with him. You know, I can't really get specific, but she, you know, she felt that he was playing games with her and stuff like that. But, she wasn't happy. But I thought he was wonderful. He was an amazing guy. And he had just done, you know, he'd done some amazing films as well. He had just done Wedding in White with, you know, some really great, Donald Pleasance, and, you know, the great movie. And, you know, so he was great. I mean, to me, he was great. So I don't have any complaints. At all.
That's good. I was a big fan of his 1986 movie, A Killer Party. I thought it was a lot of fun, too.
Uh-huh. Yep. I don't know where he is now, but anyway.
Justin, you want to go back and start another one?
Just say, after Jamie Lee Curtis's role in Halloween, a lot of these films followed on, and it was almost sort of de rigueur to have a final girl in slasher movies and horror movies. Did you enjoy playing that role? And looking back on it now, how do you sort of look back? Do you look back with fondness to those roles from the early 80s?
You mean for, like, a Funeral Home or...
Well, all of the films you did around that time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, at that time, that's what they were making in Canada. They were making comedies like Meatballs and Porky's and those type of films. And then they were making the horror films like Prom Night and, you know, Funeral Home and My Bloody Valentine, all those stuff, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, for me, it was work. So, yeah, I mean, it was great. It was a lot of fun. I was working with my peers and, you know, I was learning my craft. And, you know, if you told me back then that they were going to have an enduring audience, I would have been like, are you serious? Really? Forget it. No, I would have laughed in your face. But yeah, no, they were an amazing, it was an amazing time. It was amazing experience. And, yeah, I have a lot of fond memories of doing those films. Even, you know, the curtains type saga, which went on forever. The filming went on forever. So, but I wasn't really a party to that at the time. And it wasn't until later that I was like, really? Seriously? What happened? You know, they filmed this and then they went back and filmed that. And so, yeah, I mean, I was pretty sheltered at the time for all of that.
Yeah,
but it was great.
I think for curtains, it's got a reputation for having, you know, this troubled production. I think
yes.
of the three main films that you're known for, I think it's my favorite of the three, easily.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, a lot of people like that movie.
when did it become apparent? Sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
So I've just wondered, when did it become apparent on the set that there was problems with the film? Was it early on, or was it after you'd done the initial filming?
A movie is usually, you know, especially a horror film, they usually, you know, take a month to make. And, you know, maybe not even that, maybe a little over a month, depending on the script. But when you're cast and you start shooting in October, November of 81, and then you don't get to the skating scene until, like, the spring of 82, and I'm serious, like, it was, like, March or April of 82, you kind of go, what's going on with this film? Why are they, you know, they kept pushing back certain, you know, filming days. So I didn't know the specifics of what was going on with it. I didn't know the troubles. I knew that, you know, obviously I started with one director and then, you know, I was on the set and it was Peter Simpson directing. So I knew there was, you know, without knowing the specifics, I knew that there was definitely some trouble going on in the production. But, you know, you show up, you do your stuff and you don't ask questions and you know what you're supposed to do. And that's that. So it wasn't until, like, you know, later years that I would hear from crew members saying, oh, yeah, so I have a T-shirt that says I was involved in the production, the never-ending production of Curtains, you know, and they would have hats or T-shirts with this on them. And I'm like, really? Oh, my God, what happened?
I'll take one in a large, please.
Yes, exactly.
I'll take one in XXL, please.
Yeah, that's it, basically, yes. I should have gotten myself a shirt.
As a follow-up to that question, Leslie, there's a picture on the back of the UK video box which shows the killer on stage with all of the other actresses surrounding her. Sorry?
Carry on, sorry.
No, do you remember filming? Was that a shock? Because it wasn't in the film. No.
I don't remember filming that.
Okay.
I really don't. Yeah, apparently this is a scene in the movie, or it was a scene in the movie, or it was, you know, a photo in the movie. And I actually, to be honest with you, I have no memory. Because that's sort of the same kind of scenario as what happened in Happy Birthday to Me. Mm. All the dead people were around the table. And there's Virginia, and she comes out with, and I remember that distinctly, filming that. But I have no memory of filming, you know, being put on a stage and you know, as a dead character and being filmed, you know, in that sequence. So I have no idea what that is.
I mean, it might, because it's a very small picture, so you can't really tell. Right. So it might not have actually been the real actresses there. They may have.
No, it probably wasn't. It definitely wasn't, because I don't remember being a part of it. So, yeah, bizarre. One of the many mysteries of Curtains.
Yeah, absolutely. What are we up, Nathan, to, Joseph? Have we,
Nathan, you got anything else to say?
Oh, well, actually, I think you kind of answered my question, my second question. I was just curious, were you surprised when, you know, you got online and got all this, you know, you realized you had a huge fan base?
Oh, very. Absolutely. Because like I said earlier, you know, if you'd told me back then that there were going to be people in the future that were going to, you know, have loved these movies, I would have said, seriously? You're kidding. No way. You know, you do a movie like that, and it's, like I said, it's a great experience. You meet people, and you learn your craft. And then, you know, you go on, and you hope that you're going to, you know, get the chance to do a Sophie's Choice. But, you know, that's the hope, you know? And at that time in the 80s, you know, horror was just basically one step up from porn. So it was my son is in the background. I don't think he knows what that is.
Welcome to the show, kid.
Hi, Gavin. Anyway, so you know, but in those days it really was. I mean, I remember when I was doing a Curtains, I actually went out with a friend of mine, and we snuck in to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I literally thought it was a snuff film. I was like, I couldn't believe what I was watching. It was that terrifying to me. And so, you know, I grew up watching horror movies. I love the Hammer horror movies. I went to see Dracula numerous times. My aunt would sneak me into these movies and tell my mother she was taking me to see Oliver or Sound of Music, but she would take me to see, you know, Dracula Rises from the Grave or The Brides of Dracula or all these great movies. And so I was raised on that. And so I always really wanted to do these kind of movies. But, it, you know, obviously when you're a young actor and you're starting out, your goal is to do the artist, you know, I'm doing quotes here, artistic movies, which is the Sophie's Choice and the Silkwoods and the French Lieutenant's Women. And Meryl Streep was the actress at that time, and Deborah Winger and Jessica Lange. And so, you know, that's where you wanted to go. Yeah, I mean, it was, it's amazing to me. I love it. I'm grateful to you guys. I mean, it's wonderful. to have fans of these movies.
I think it's great that you converse with your fans on Facebook and actually reply to their posts as well. And I'm still trying to figure out how to get gay abs. I haven't figured it out yet, but I will.
What is that? What is gay what?
Remember when you responded to my Facebook post about, I posted about, you know, I have straight abs, I want gay abs.
Gay abs. We all want gay abs.
You don't want my abs.
I know. Thank God for Facebook, right? You know, Facebook is amazing. It's allowed me to sort of have a persona that... You know, Joseph was saying, I hope you can bring your sassy self on this interview.
Yeah, I just want to say I am steadfast with you on your whole stance on Charlie Sheen. I am.
Oh,
I'm
Charlie.
I'm proud of you for all the posts that you put on
Charlie Sheen. Yes, it's kind of gotten lost in all the, you know, the horrible tragedy that's happened with Japan. And
I was going to make a post about that, but I thought it was in kind of bad taste. You know, the tsunami kind of killed Charlie Sheen's career.
It took his thunder. Yes, basically. He's not winning anymore. Yeah, but no, Facebook is great, and I think it's a really wonderful thing. I mean, obviously, I mean, look what it's doing for you know, the people of the Middle East. It's helping them, you know, wake them up and see that they have choices and they don't have to live under dictatorships. But you know, it's great to be able to hook up with people who like what you do and converse with them. I think it's really a wonderful medium. Absolutely wonderful.
All right, I think I'm going to ask you, unless anyone else has anything to ask.
Well, go ahead, Joseph. Listen.
Unless anyone else has anything to ask, I think I was not going to take up too much more of your time. I was just going to ask one final question.
Sure.
It's a simple question. Out of the movies you've done, which one was your favorite to do?
Out of the horror films?
What you had the most fun with, yeah.
Well, I'd have to say I really enjoyed doing Funeral Home because I was on the set most of the time. And I really, you know, I love doing movies because I love the atmosphere of working with a crew. I think they're great. And but I have to say that... it was a lot of fun doing Happy Birthday to Me too. And even though I had the smallest part, the kids that were in that movie were my peers at the time. And, you know, we all knew each other from, you know, auditioning together for other stuff and hanging out in the, you know, in the Toronto film scene back in the day. So, that was a lot of fun. And,
there was the best line in Happy Birthday to Me. Give mommy dad.
Yes, I did, didn't I? Poor Frances Highland. it was a lot of fun to do. And of course, at the time, you know, J. Lee Thompson was an amazing director and amazing to work with and work for. I didn't really, you know, ignorance is bliss when you're young. I didn't really know his status when I was working with him. I mean, I had no idea his pedigree and what he, you know, what he'd done before. So, you know, you show up and you do your best and all of that. But it was a lot of fun to do, and you know, everybody was great to work with. But you know, all the films were fun to do. So when you're, I was a teenager, so it was like, you know, summer camp for me. Anything to get out of school. That's great.
Are you still in touch with some of the people on the film? You know, some of the people you worked with back on some of the films you did.
You know, it's funny, again, we're bringing everything back to Facebook, but, you know, I hadn't been for years, and then suddenly when I started getting, you know, I jumped on Facebook, I reconnected with a lot of those people. I don't converse with them regularly, but they are, you know, friends of mine, and you know, if I do send them a message, they'll respond, but, and maybe hopefully one day we'll have like a, you know, a reunion, you never know.
That'll be great.
It'd be fun at one of those conventions, but, I mean, I don't know. I don't hang out with them, and I hadn't conversed with them, you know, like I said, in a long time. But Facebook has kind of reconnected us. So,
because I saw there was recent. I think it was John Durning, one of the producers of Happy Birthday to Me, sort of said that he's found some uncut footage in the film, which would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yes, I saw that interview. Terror Trap guys did that, and a wonderful interview that they did with him. I didn't know that. That's really amazing. Wouldn't that be fun if he could, you know, get that footage and re-release it? Who knows?
It'd be fantastic.
That'd be great. Yeah, it would be.
It'd be great if you could do a media commentary for one of the films as well.
It'd be great. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So if anyone's listening.
Lots of fun.
I'd definitely buy it.
Yeah, so would I.
Well, I think there's going to be a documentary on, I want to say A&E, but I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that. Mm. On the 4th of April that they're doing for Scream, the Scream movies.
Okay, yeah.
And they're paying homage to, you know, movies like Happy Birthday to Me and, you know, the early 80s Scream films. Mm. So the early 80s slasher films. Basically, that kind of propelled Wes Craven. And he, I mean, in his Scream, you know, movies that he's done, he took from those movies. So they're going to show some, I think, some footage from Happy Birthday to Me and Prom Night and stuff like that.
Excellent.
So,
excellent.
Yeah, check it out. Check it out. Yeah, April 4th.
It's the Scream documentary directed by Daniel Ferrans, isn't it? Does anyone know that? The Nightmare on Elm Street, Never Sleep Again.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. This is basically, I think, just a documentary based on the first Scream movie.
Cool.
And because Scream, I think the fourth one is coming out soon. So I think they're doing, they're paying homage to Wes Craven and his Scream franchise and basically what he was paying homage to all the early 80s slasher films that came out. So, and Happy Birthday was one of them. So that's kind of exciting.
Well, they should get you in Scream 5, Leslie. Would you like to turn up as a killer at the end?
Would I play the killer?
Would you like to turn up in the last reel?
Oh, hell yeah, of course. Sure, why not?
We should start a petition online today. Mm.
Absolutely, petition. Like Betty White. You never know, right?
It worked for her, right?
It worked for her. Absolutely. She's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yep. Well, is there anything else anybody wanted to ask? Because we've taken up quite a lot of your time already, Leslie, and we're very grateful for you spending some time with us. Guys, is there anything else?
I guess no one else has anything, do they?
No.
I don't think we're okay.
No, yeah, I'll just see you on Facebook, Leslie.
Yes, I'm on Facebook. I'll be there.
She is amazing. I don't. It would be great to get, like you say, one of the conventions and have everyone come together and actually have a Scream Queen table. That would be amazing, wouldn't it?
It would be great. And actually, speaking of conventions, I will be at a convention in June. I'll be at the Saturday Nightmare. So,
okay.
In New Jersey. So if you're around and you're up that way, come by. I'd love to meet you guys.
Do you know what date? You know what date that is?
Yes, it's June 3rd to 5th.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. We're going to be
Monster Mania.
Yeah, June 3rd to 5th. At Monster Mania, yes.
Yes.
Are we going up?
But yeah, listen to my kid. Are we going, Mommy? That's my younger son, who I always say will be the Rob Zombie, future Rob Zombie, right here.
And I'm the director.
Yes, thank you. I'm creating monsters, so to speak.
You have no idea.
No idea, right? The future Rob Zombie's here. Though they do, they love horror movies. So,
you passed all your love to them.
But yeah, so if you're around June 3rd to 5th, come by East Rutherford, New Jersey. I'll be there.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Leslie. And we'll speak to you soon on Facebook.
You got it. All right, guys. Thank you.
Again, thank you.
Okay. All right.
Take care. All right.
You too.
All right.
Bye. Bye, Leslie. Bye.
I'm still in training. God knows why. I get up every morning at dawn to practice.
Dawn?
I bet you're fun on dates.
Makes me feel good. Guess you gotta want it more than being loved. Isn't that how you feel about acting?
It depends on the love.
And thank you again to the wonderful Leslie Donaldson for joining us. That was an absolute pleasure, and I hope you enjoyed that interview. And As we spoke, obviously we've just covered Curtains, one of the films that the wonderful Leslie appeared in. And obviously Happy Birthday to Me, with a few audio clips in there from Happy Birthday to Me. But the film that she was ostensibly, I kind of guess, the final girl in was Funeral Home. Now, Funeral Home was made, as Leslie said, when she was only 15, which is amazing because not many actors or actresses get a chance to appear in films. As we know, most slasher movies have got overaged teenagers, i.e. 30-year-olds playing 18-year-olds. So it's refreshing to see somebody who looks that young. Now, in case you haven't seen Funeral Home, essentially, a synopsis of it is that Heather, which is Leslie Donaldson's character, goes to spend a summer with her grandmother at the guest house she's opened at what used to be the funeral home run by her husband, who is missing. The police are baffled by local disappearances, which are linked back to the guest house. Heather begins to get suspicious when she hears her grandmother talking to someone in the basement. Pretty soon, more bodies start to hit the floor, killed by someone holding an embalming pipe. Now, a little bit more about Funeral Home. It was directed by William Fruitt, who, again, it's another Canadian production, and shot in and around the same kind of area as Curtains was, near Toronto. I believe there's a gorge, which is where all the underwater sequences and swimming sequences, where some characters go swimming and they discover a body, was somewhere called Alora Gorge, which was the same area which I believe the Jane Wan's Dead Silence was shot as well. Fruitt also directed the giant snake movie Spasms, Death Weekend, and also the mid-80s kind of slasher spoofy film Killer Party. Now, Funeral Home, I believe, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I believe it was released... it was shot in 79. The exact dates when it shot between 23rd of July and the 12th of September 1979. Now, it's released in Canada, I believe, under its original title, which was Cries in the Night, in 1980. And indeed, I actually have the Dutch videotape in front of me, and the original... under the title Cries in the Night, and the original tagline was, "They were warned, they were all warned, don't go down to the cellar, cries in the night, it will have you screaming for morning." Now, obviously, that harks back to the tagline for the original Friday 13th. And certainly Funeral Home was made with a view of certainly not cashing in on Friday 13th, because it was made before Friday 13th's release, but certainly on Halloween. But it didn't get released in the States until 1982. But again, by which time the slash movie boom had all but was over. But Variety reported it was actually pretty successful for its low budget film of this type. It made over $4 million at the box office, which in today's money would be a lot more, and certainly more than a lot of slash movies, low budget slash movies made, around the time. I mean, certainly, something like Mortuary or something would have made less than $1 million. Despite what some sources say. So I really enjoyed Funeral Home. It's not as good as Happy Birthday to Me or Curtains, but I do like the quirky nature of it. Where it does fall down, unfortunately, which I think you guys might agree with me, is that it kind of falls apart towards the end. It's almost, in some ways, a slightly apologetic slash movie. Kay Hawtrey, who, as Leslie talked about, didn't get on with William Fruitt, I thought she was really good and reminded me, she's playing the grandmother, reminded me of the woman in another Pete Walker movie, in Frightmare, who played the cannibalistic granny in that. Sheila Keith, and in Funeral Home, I really liked her performance. She went from manically kind of perky to actually quite disturbing at the end, when it turns out, and here's the spoiler for you, it turns out that she is killing people. She's been driven mad and schizophrenic. My problem with the film is that Leslie is fantastic in it and really likable lead. And she has a kind of slightly Nancy Drewish kind of role where she thinks things are going. Guests are disappearing from the funeral home / guest house, and she tries to find out what it is, and she doesn't realise until it's too late that her grandmother is mental, basically, and is killing people. But the ending, it kind of ends very abruptly, with a nod to Psycho, even down to the lampshade that swings, sending light cascading around the room, which is what obviously Hitchcock did, and also having the desiccated body of her grandfather sat in a chair, which is the big reveal. But yeah, well, that's my views. What about you guys? What did you think of Funeral Home? Who wants to go first? Joseph?
I think I disagree with you, where, as you said, it kind of falls apart at the end. I think it actually kind of picks up at the end, and kind of everything before that kind of drags a little. You said in the description of the film where the police are baffled. I love how they put in the police are baffled, because in Funeral Home, there's only a deputy who seems, you know, somewhat concerned, where, you know, the sheriff is like, oh, people go missing all the time. If they want to be found, they will. If they want to go missing, they'll go missing. And it's always like that. We talked about that in House of Death as well. People are always saying, oh, they're just probably out doing something else or something like that. But yeah, I thought that was hilarious. And you know, I liked the grandmother's performance, and I liked Leslie's performance. But I think for the most part, it's a little tedious. There were instances, you know, where I'm sitting there thinking it really needs to pick up now, because it's got really good atmosphere and it's got like a pretty good premise going on, but it just takes forever to get to where it really is supposed to be going. And when it finally gets there, I'm like, okay, this is exciting, but it's too little too late.
Okay. Well, interesting. Well, it's always good to get differing opinions. How about you, Nathan? How do you find Funeral Home?
I like Funeral Home. It was actually the last of the three Leslie horror movies that I saw. And when I saw it, I was like, finally, because I always thought that I wanted to see what she'd be like as a final girl, because she's always getting killed. So it was nice to see her in a final girl role. And I think my biggest complaints about Funeral Home is I think it needed a bigger body count. I like the idea of a bed and breakfast that used to be a funeral home and people are disappearing, but I don't know, like, it's like only two people that are guests there get killed, and their death scene to me was actually not that exciting. Like, it wasn't very slasher-esque to me. I wanted it to be a little more heavier on the slasher side, I think. I still enjoy the movie, though, and, like, you know, you guys have said Kay Hawtrey is excellent in it, as is Leslie. She really takes the lead with the final girl role, and she does a really good job with it. And the finale, I think, is fantastic. I love with Kay Hawtrey just going completely wacko in the cellar and just picking up that axe and slamming it into everything that's in her path to get to Leslie. I thought that was really well done. So overall, I really like the movie. It's probably not in my top 10, not one of my, you know, favorites, but it's still a good movie.
Now, Nathan, you can't say anything because you know, but Justin and Eric, did you know that the killer in Funeral Home was in another sort of recent slasher film? Do you know what it was?
Urban Legend.
Oh, yes, you do. Okay.
Kay Hawtrey was in Urban Legend.
She was.
She was the librarian.
She's a librarian.
Ah, all right.
So, yeah, sorry, I was going to, sorry to steal your Sunday well, there, Joseph.
Oh, and can I also say that
I'll get you
the this. Killer is very, very easy to face. Guess, but yes. Our friend Grant, was completely shocked at the ending.
How could he be shocked at that? You remember
he was like, oh my gosh, it was her!
You remember the first time we watched it about 10 years ago? The first time we watched it about 10 years ago, we would get on 30 seconds and I said, she's the killer, it's a psycho riff. And you were like, yeah, you're right. And he was so shocked. He was like, oh, I can't believe it was her.
Well, can we just before we come to you, Eric, and we'll talk about it a bit more, but what I forgot to play the trailer for this, just as we're talking about Kay Hawtrey here, because the trailer is actually one of those trailers, luckily I listened to before I played it, because it's like a minute of discordant noise with nothing happening, which is great if you're looking at it with visuals, but when you're looking at it, when you're listening to it, it's probably not very exciting. So I've edited the trailer down a little bit, so it's just a little bit of Kay Hawtrey going nutsoid.
Can't I get it, screamer?
Yeah, there you go. So, Eric, what did you think of it?
Well, it's interesting what you're talking about Kay Hawtrey, because the thing I noted about her performance in it is she really reminded me of Shelley Winters in What's the Matter with Helen and Whoever Slew Auntie Rue. She had that kind of homely grandmother who's just a teensy bit demented. As for the film itself, as Nathan said, it could have done with being a bit more slashery, I thought. I think because it was made in the limbo between Halloween and Friday the 13th, it's a different film from the ones from 1981 onwards. Had it been made after Friday the 13th, I think it would have been a much better picture, with punctuated with more excitement and more kills and more suspense. Mm-hmm. I think it reminds me very much of a 70s TV movie. It's quaint. Not a huge amount happens in it. And I agree with Joseph as well. I think for me, it picks up in the final 15 minutes or so, because up until that point, I found it a bit too slow for my tastes. But, I mean, it is terrific. And as you said, it's not terrific. The performances are terrific from Leslie and Kay Hawtrey. And we should also give mention to Alfred Humphreys, who's in there, who we will remember from My Bloody Valentine, the original. He is one of the victims. I can't remember how he dies in My Bloody Valentine off the top of my head, but he's in there anyway. Where we tried contacting him because he is on Facebook, but we got no response, possibly because he's disowning his slasher beginnings.
I know, what have they got to hide? It's nothing.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't believe that some people had difficulty guessing the killer's identity, because I'm usually bottom of the class when it comes to guessing killer's identities. I couldn't guess who was the killer in Scream 4. Joseph, I know you said it was quite easy for you. For me, it was quite tricky. But even I could guess the killer in Funeral Home. I mean, I didn't even know it was supposed to be a mystery. It was made clear up front at the very beginning of the film.
That's what I thought too when I watched it.
There didn't seem to be anyone else who it could have been, really. Well, I suppose it could have been. I think that was probably where the film falls down. And when saying about it fell apart at the end, I didn't really mean the bits where Kay Hawtrey is going nutsoid and smashing stuff with an axe, because that builds up quite nicely. It was just literally the end where it kind of like... There's a bizarre thing, because we talked to Leslie about that black cat Mittens, who she was scared of.
Lovely Mittens.
Lovely Mittens, who just happens to be, every time there's a murder, the cat seems to be about. But at the end, the cat is sat in the with the dead, you know, the husband, and Kay Hawtrey is going, "You will die," you know, whatever. But she's about to kill Leslie, my one regret with the film is the fact that Leslie, rather than doing full-out final girl, which I would have loved to have seen her doing a real Amy Steele or Jamie Lee or whatever, and just being able to really kind of, you know, do a kind of Nicolas Cage sucker punch to her grandmother, and like he does in The Wicker Man, and sort of, you know, do some kind of fighting. She's left on the floor whimpering, which is probably more realistic. But what seems to actually turn the grandmother back to her normal self is the black cat, who suddenly runs across the floor, and then her grandmother seems to be back to her normal self, going, "Are you all right, dear? Do you want a cup of tea?" That kind of thing. And so that was kind of weird. That was weird. But that was where it kind of just went. It was like building up into a, like, thinking, "Wow, this is really going somewhere," and then it stops. And it's a bit like, oh, that's where I meant it kind of went off the rails a bit at the end. It kind of built up into a crescendo, but it just was a bit more of a whimper than a bang that I think may have really elevated it into, you know, a much better movie. But I liked...
Can I just throw out this really ridiculous theory that Grant and our friend Jamie came up with? They think... this is funny now, listen.
Yeah.
They think the black cat was the reincarnation of the grandfather.
Okay.
Isn't that stupid?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, why would he come back to save her when he was a bastard to begin with?
Yeah, why would you? And Grant was like, "Well, maybe he wanted to atone for his sins." Or was that Jamie that said that?
That was Jamie, that said that. Maybe he wants to atone for his sins. Like, the movie gives no indication that that's what's going on.
Who knows?
I just say you're very, very mean to your friends.
Yeah, and they're not listening. My friends.
Hear the way they talk to us.
Okay. Yeah, we all talk that way to each other.
Yeah, that's just the way we are.
My two favorite characters, apart from Leslie and the Kay Hawtrey's characters, were Harvey Atkin and Peggy Mahoon, who played the the boozy kind of
they're brilliant.
You know, couple who were out to have a good time, and Kay Hawtrey's like clutching her pearls, going, oh, "Get out of my guest house!" And they were just like going, "Oh, sod off," you know. And it was kind of, and they're just kind of like, and I love it when Kay Hawtrey's making all those kind of flowers, or artificial flowers, and. Peggy Mahoon goes, oh, I love beautiful things. And like Kay Hawtrey looks at her like,
oh, yeah.
She's a complete idiot. You know, stuff like that is kind of, I really like about the movie. It's kind of got that quirkiness. And of course, the other thing is, it's a Canadian movie. And like most Canadian movies, like My Bloody Valentine and probably Curtains, I imagine, it's all set in America. And obviously, that's all done for business reasons because America, you know, the United States is a much bigger market. But I didn't see it this time, but I did see on IMDb and the gaffes that apparently there is a massive Canadian flag flying outside a building in Funeral Home, even though it's obviously, presumably, I think it's probably set in the South, isn't it? Probably sort of near your neck of the woods, Joseph and Nathan. No.
Actually, okay. I don't know where it's supposed to be set. Actually,
but it seemed it looked like the South, but then
it's like Iowa or some kind of Kansas farm or something.
That's near Tennessee, isn't it? Is that?
I don't know.
No. Okay. Right. Anyway,
we have Canadian flags here.
Do you? Right. Okay.
I have one in my living room.
Is that because you love Canada?
Yes.
Yes,
I love Canada.
Right. Well, on that bombshell,
what are we talking about today? This is the weirdest show ever. Before we go on, you gave me an idea when you were talking about how obvious the killer was in Funeral Home. That gave me an idea. What about a top three?
Top three.
You broke up there.
I stopped because I got tongue tied. Top three unobvious killers.
Unobvious killers. I think that'd be really.
Is unobvious a word?
Unobvious.
I'm making it a word.
Okay.
We'll talk about them. And my only concern with that, Joseph, is we would have to spoil 12 films.
Yes.
That might be a problem. Do you think or not?
I worry if people would listen to that because they might be afraid of we might spoil one film that they like and they might like fast forward that whole sequence in the podcast.
We spoil more than that. We spoil everything.
We do, apart from Scream 4, but apart from...
Yeah, but mostly we spoil the movie we are discussing, like the main movie.
This is true.
So they can expect that.
Well, anyway. I think we could do maybe... We'll fight about this on off air because... our lovely listeners, and also if you've got any of our listeners have got any ideas, top threes, then do drop them to us. I know BTK has given us a few in the past off the forums.
Why don't we do top trees? Oak. No.
Top pine. Three. Top three trees.
Top trees.
Balsa. Balsa.
Top three oaks.
What's this dogwood?
Susie.
Sorry.
Toya.
I don't even know what we're talking about now.
Okay,
well, Susie's a tree. She's as old as a tree.
Well, funny enough, now that you've brought us onto that subject, Joseph, I think we can come on to my surprise section.
Oh no!
Which I've been teasing the guys about. Now, long-time listeners, although we've only been going a couple of months, might be aware that there is a certain rivalry amongst two pop stars. And for me, there's Susie Sue from Susie and the Banshees, one of my favourite ever groups and one of the greatest front women of all time. And and there's Toya who anyway, so there's Toya and there's Susie. So but what I thought would be quite a nice thing to do is what I've done is I've edited a minute of each of their best moments. And I thought lovely listeners could write in to see who they think's their favourite. Now, it's very short, this, but I thought if I start with Susie, and then we won't discuss it necessarily, but our listeners could write in and tell us who their favourites. Now, here's the best of Susie.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's some of the best bits of Susie. So I think it's only fair now to follow with some of the best bits.
What
of
are
Sawyer.
You going to do?
Sorry?
Oh, my God, here we go.
Yeah, I think I know what you're up to. Go on.
Here we go, some of the best bits of Toya. Eric, you know, you have, must have faith in me. Who's your favorite? Is it Susie or
double.
Toya?
I picked double.
Sorry?
I picked Cyndi Lauper.
Only that first clip was Toya.
I don't know. Actually, all of that was Toya. I think if you want to write in, tell us who's your favorite, then Joseph, can you give the address again out, please?
We are doublefans at gmail.com.
We used to call them Dubla over here because they were Swiss, I think.
Dubla?
Dubla was that where they used to be pronounced on Top of the Pops. Yeah.
See, it's spelled like double, so I always pronounced it double.
Yeah, they're terrible too, by the way.
Hey. You guys, listen to me. I want you guys to know that you're all the captains of my heart.
Well, thank you. Well, maybe we can have a Dubla or double or shit or whatever they're called podcast later. So on that bombshell, I think we'll bring it to an end. And I just wanted to sort of put the rivalry to bed once and for all between Susie and Toya.
Yeah,
and hopefully we've done that today. And if we we've made some peace amongst us. So thank you for listening.
Yeah,
and
Rupert Murdoch.
Thank you for listening. And we are going to lead out on some music from Kearns.